From Jefferson Public Radio at Southern Oregon University, this is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Off the top, rivers and rocks and making rocks and other materials into asphalt. That's what's got some people upset in the Oregon City of Talent. You'll hear about the ruckus raised by an asphalt plant located along a creek and in a residential zone. Down the hour, Wednesday is Vents Day on the Jefferson Exchange, your chance to put your thoughts front and center on a pair of issues. Let's hear what you think of the levy results in yesterday's election, or talk about public university president salaries. After nine, when a country's president pays a visit to the White House, that country and ours must get along pretty well, right? That's the usual thinking. But Myanmar's president made the visit this week, and Burmese freedom activists are not happy about it. All that and your phone calls and emails ahead on the Jefferson Exchange after this hour's news. It's 8:06, and you're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We broadcast live weekday mornings and rebroadcast weekday evenings on radio stations serving Oregon and California. We are also found online. Our website is jeffexchange.org, which includes a listen live link. Click that, and you can listen to us through our streaming service anywhere you can get the internet. No radio necessary. It is Wednesday, May 22nd, 2013. I'm Jeffrey Riley, and I'm glad you're along for the ride today. In this hour, the argument over an asphalt plant and Vents Day. You'll hear about the plant making pavement just outside city limits in Talent from the people who say it is operating just outside the law. Then, in Vents Day, your opinions take center stage. Tell us what you think of yesterday's local election results in Oregon or what public university presidents should be paid. You can join our discussions on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. First, let's get a weather forecast. It is quite a bit different from yesterday, as we had predicted. Here is Jefferson Exchange producer Charlotte Duran.
On the Northern California coast today, a chance of showers and windy and mostly sunny with a high near 54. Tonight, a chance of showers and windy and mostly cloudy with a low around 40. In Redding and Red Bluff today, mostly sunny with a high near 70. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low around 52. In Yreka today, a freeze warning till 9 a.m., then partly sunny with a high near 57. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around 34. In Weed and Mount Shasta today, partly sunny with a high near 55. Tonight, mostly cloudy and windy with a low around 31. On the southern Oregon coast today, showers and windy with a high near 53. Tonight, showers and windy with a low around 45. In the Klamath Basin today, a freeze warning until 9 a.m., then a slight chance of snow mixed with rain and windy and partly sunny with a high near 50. Tonight, a slight chance of rain mixed with snow and windy and mostly cloudy with a low around 31. In Grants Pass, Medford, and Ashland today, showers likely and windy and cloudy with a high near 60. Tonight, a chance of showers and windy, then mostly cloudy with a low around 41. On the southern Oregon Cascades and Siskiyous today, 1 to 3 inches of snow possible and windy with a high near 40. Tonight, less than half an inch of snow possible, windy and mostly cloudy with a low around 27. In Roseburg and the Umpqua Basin today, showers and windy with a high near 55. Tonight, showers likely and cloudy with a low around 43. And in Eugene and Springfield today, showers and windy with a high near 53. Tonight, showers and windy with a low around 44.
So it has turned sharply colder as predicted, and we're only going to creep back into the normal ranges for this time of year. To give you an idea how far off we are, the high for Medford today is about 15 degrees below what is generally expected for this time of the year. And I believe, based on what I saw yesterday, that the record overnight low could... No, I say, well, how did this work? The record high for today or tomorrow could actually be a record low high for that date. So that's what's going on in our area. And as I climbed up the hill in the car on the way to Ashland this morning, I looked around and realized that as I looked across the valley, snow was just about at the same level I was, which would place it at about 1,800 or 2,000 feet, which is not terribly high for, what are we saying, a month away from summer at this point. Radar doesn't show much activity around the region at this point. Some in the Eugene area clustered from there on northward, and I see a lot of blue in the Cascade, so a lot of snow is falling in the mountains at this point. Mountain passes, not much of an issue at this point, it would appear. Nothing sticking to the pavement, do terribly much. But just be advised that if you are crossing mountains today, in your vehicle, you might want to take some wintertime precautions because there is wintertime weather up there, which is really interesting, too, because it was just last week, I believe, that the Forest Service declared the Bear Camp Road open west of Grants Pass on the way to Gold Beach, and the Park Service opened up the north entrance to Crater Lake, both of which are very likely to get snowed back in over the course of today and tomorrow. Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We are always glad when you take part in our conversations, which you're welcome to do. Phone numbers again, 800-838-3760, toll-free around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It is not unusual to find industrial activity close to a stream. Streams are great places to find rocks, and so quarries and aggregate operations are fairly common. But when those also include the making of pavement, the story changes a bit, and so it has in Talent, just north of Ashland. The Mountain View paving operation along Bear Creek includes an asphalt plant, much to the chagrin of nearby residents. They have been mobilizing support, or I should say they've been mobilizing opposition to the plant, and have gained an ally in opposing the plant in the group Rogue Advocates. We have two guests with us from Rogue Advocates here in the studio. Steve Rouse is the board president. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning, Jeff.
Good to have you here. And Melissa Mathewson is the executive director of Rogue Advocates, joining us by phone. Welcome, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. I do want to explain that we extended an offer to Mountain View Paving to tell its side of the story. We have not confirmed a time yet, but we do hope to have a representative on the air next week. So one of you, please start us off and tell us, first of all, what is Rogue Advocates? Melissa Mathewson, let's start with you.
Sure. Rogue Advocates is a nonprofit organization here in the Rogue Valley, formed in 2006. And our mission is to cultivate livable and sustainable communities in the Rogue Valley. And we do this through advocacy, education, and outreach around local land use. We're actually celebrating Oregon's 40 years of progressive land use with our land use system. And so Rogue Advocates works locally to kind of advocate for sustainable land use. And so that means preserving farmland, promoting vibrant urban centers, advocating for smart growth, productive rural lands, and so that's mainly what we've been working on.
So in general, adherence to the land use system as devised by the Senate Bill 100 40 years ago.
Yes.
All right. Steve Rouse, tell us a bit more about the specifics, though, of what's going on with Mountain View Paving and how Rogue Advocates got involved in this.
Sure. We were contacted, actually, by nearby neighbors, and that's actually how we first became aware of the fact that the asphalt plant didn't have any land use permits. Now, I remember driving by. The plant is located right off I-5, highly visible. You can see it right at the Talent exit there. And I remember driving by in 2002 or so and seeing the plant and seeing the emissions coming out of it. And I was amazed that it could be located there, and I figured it was probably just a portable plant and just kind of ignored it. But that was probably a mistake because, as it turns out, they had no land use permits and they'd continued to operate really for the last 12 years without land use authority. And so what instigated this application that they're now in the process of is code enforcement from Jackson County actually went out and saw a lot of the development there on the facility and believed it was, you know, obviously researched it, saw that there were no permits, and that's what instigated the application from the applicant. Code enforcement requested that they either apply and get proper land use authorization or they had to move.
And for either one of you, how was it that it had been able to continue for all that time until this point recently, as you say, when code enforcement came out and said, hey, you can't be doing this here?
When I contacted Jackson County Development Services for planning, they said that basically their code enforcement is complaint driven and that unless they receive complaints, they just don't have the manpower to go around and look for violations. They only research those if there's complaints. So unfortunately, with all the cutbacks and staff reductions at the county, that's just the way it works here in Jackson County, is that unless folks complain about something that they feel is not legal, Jackson County will not instigate any enforcement.
So somebody must have complained.
Yeah, some complaint was submitted, and code enforcement basically issued the citations and required that they either, like I said, either make an application or move. And we weren't really even aware of the complaint until the application was filed And then we started looking into the specifics.
There has been some kind of an aggregate operation there for quite some time, though, hasn't there? I mean, I've lived in that general area for 20 years now.
Historically, there's been an aggregate on and off, aggregate operation on and off at that time. You know, when I-5 was built in the 60s, that entire area of Bear Creek from Talent to Ashland was excavated for rock for construction, either for I-5 or other paving projects or construction projects. So there has been an operation on and off site in that area, but it hasn't been continuous. And that's one of the things that's a problem with the application. The other thing is that an aggregate operation is one type of use, and an asphalt operation is a very distinctly different type of use according to state law and Jackson County law. It is an industrial operation, and it requires specific zoning for an industrial use, and that property is zoned RR5.
Meaning rural residential.
Rural residential 5, exactly, 5 acres.
So 5-acre lots, basically, for any house?
5-acre lot for any house there. This particular parcel where the asphalt plant operates is 11 acres. And, you know, it's quite possible. There's really no bad guy in this application. It's quite possible that the operator thought they had land use approval because there had been an aggregate operation on site. They first applied for an application in 2011, 2 years ago, for nonconforming use for an aggregate operation. And the asphalt plant was called an expansion of that. We went through the hearing process. Rogue Advocates appealed that application also. And I believe we were very successful in the appeal in that we went through the entire appeal process, and just before the decision was made, they withdrew the application. So no decision was made. And now they've reapplied with this new application. The first application said there'd been an aggregate site operation on site before land use laws in 1973. The new application says, no, this has been an asphalt plant all that time, not an aggregate operation.
So it sounds like what you're telling me is that you're getting different stories depending on when the application is put in, or different stories with each application.
It appears the applicant has actually submitted different versions of their story.
Melissa Mathewson is the executive director at Rogue Advocates, and Steve Rouse is the board president, and we're talking about the dust-up over an asphalt plant located just outside the city limits in Talent, Oregon. You can join us as part of this discussion on the exchange in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Around the region, 800-838-3760. Melissa Mathewson, what are the complaints that neighbors are making about the asphalt plant?
Well, as far as I know, I think it has to do with related to air quality. And Steve, correct me if I'm wrong on this. As well as operation hours, is that correct, Steve?
The air quality is certainly a concern. The noise generates a lot of concern when they're operating there, and as well as the dust that's distributed. And there's a lot of concern environmental concerns as far as toxicity are not really a part of the land use system. They're addressed by the Department of Environmental Quality. So that is not an issue that Rogue Advocates is involved with in this land use appeal. We're really appealing the use itself. And so the use itself does pertain to the noise that's generated, the dust that is associated with this type of asphalt operation.
So where do things stand now then? Because I understand that there have been some activities with people seeking petition signatures. Who are they petitioning and for what?
Well, it's interesting. Rogue Advocates filed an appeal. Where this application is at is Jackson County issued a preliminary approval of two applications. There's a nonconforming use application and the development in the floodplain. They preliminarily approved both applications. Rogue Advocates appealed both applications. And the City of Talent joined in as an appellant in the interest of protecting the residents of the City of Talent. And this petition that's been going around that I think is available at a lot of businesses in Talent, and I believe it's available online as well, is residents stating their agreement with the City of Talent that they need to pursue an appeal of this, that they should protest this operation in the urban growth boundary of the City of Talent to protect the safety and health of the residents. So there is a kind of a grassroots movement from the residents and citizens of the City of Talent.
But if the city was one of the appellants, why is there this need for a petition drive?
Well, there's been a lot of conversation at the town council meetings with the mayor and council members and city manager about the expense of an appeal and whether they should really follow through on it or just drop back and let Rogue Advocates carry the weight of the appeal.
And so so where is the appeal being done? Is it at the county level? Is it up one level?
No, it's at the county level. It will be before the hearings officer, independent hearings officer for Jackson County, and that hearing is June 24th. The nonconforming use hearing is at 9 in the morning. The floodplain development hearing is at 1:30, and that's a Monday, June 24th.
So could you end up with a split decision here? I mean, could you end up with Mountain View Paving getting, for example, an okay for the nonconforming use but not for the floodplain development, or vice versa?
You could get a split decision, but if it's a split decision, they need to win both appeals. They need to prevail on both. And the difference is the nonconforming use is a pretty straightforward application, and what it's stating is that the operation has been there before land use laws went into effect on September 1st, 1973. So it's exempt from all land use laws. That is what a nonconforming use application would verify. And Rogue Advocates is very concerned that if that is approved, that this operation would be able to operate exempt from county and state laws that were implemented 40 years ago in 1973. It's a rather rare application that someone's trying to get nonconforming use going back 40 years.
Which is essentially they're asking to be grandfathered in because they say their operation existed before land use laws did.
That's exactly right. Now, the floodplain development application in the afternoon is really more of the nuts and bolts of what is the operation going to entail, what are the structures, what are the uses, et cetera. And the reason they need to apply for that as well is that federal law dictates a lot of activities within the floodplain because of FEMA regulations. And so the floodplain development application has to conform with these are basically federal laws. So even though they're exempt from county and state laws through this grandfathering of a nonconforming use, they still need to comply with the floodplain development application rules that basically protect the stream corridor, the riparian corridor, and protect, again, the health and safety of residents up and downstream from any damages that may occur if that plant area were to flood. And the entire operation is within the floodplain.
We're talking to Steve Rouse and Melissa Mathewson of Rogue Advocates about the asphalt plant in Talent run by Mountain View Paving. And again, the folks in Mountain View Paving have been offered an opportunity to tell their side of the story. We do hope to get them scheduled for the program for next week. When we talk about, you mentioned the jurisdiction of DEQ where it relates to air quality. Has the Department of Environmental Quality been brought in to consult on what comes out of this asphalt plant?
As far as I understand, the plant is in compliance with the air quality standards for DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. Now, one has to remember that those rules, those environmental rules, are basically dictated by industry lobbies for certain limitations that are very generous for exhaust and emissions of gases and such. And so, yes, they are in compliance as far as I understand, and they will need to continue to be in compliance with the air quality. However, there is no water quality permits that have been issued, no stormwater permits, no discharge permits, wastewater permits, et cetera. And we're concerned, as far as an environmental concern, and we've talked with Rogue Riverkeeper about their concerns about the impact on Bear Creek that flows directly into the Rogue, of course, is what's going on with the water there and what happens to all these toxins from trucks, from the production of asphalt and such in an area that's directly adjacent to a stream. What happens to the fish? And fish are an important issue here. This is critical habitat for coho. And so now we get into the Endangered Species Act and everything that entails as well.
Let us take a call. We have Richard in Talent on the Jefferson Exchange. Welcome. You're talking to Steve Rouse and Melissa Mathewson.
Hi. A couple questions. One is, I'm not sure exactly what the nonconforming land use permits someone not to conform to. And if there were contradictory stories told in the filing of two applications, what I learned back in the third grade was that if there are two contradictory editions of something, one or both of them are lies. Good guys don't lie. And the other question is, what are the penalties for having operated without a permit for over a decade? And if there are penalties, why are they not being imposed? And if there are no penalties, what incentive is there for a business to ever apply for one and risk having it turned down?
All right. Thanks for the call, Richard. Appreciate it. So non-conforming use and the contradictions thereof and any penalties from doing this outside of the bounds of a permit.
Richard, those are some great questions, and I'll try to handle them real quickly. The non-conforming use means that they are exempt from those land use laws that were introduced in 1973. Before 1973, there were no land use laws in the state of Oregon, and so if this operation existed prior to that, like Jeffrey said, they are exempt, they're grandfathered, and so they don't need to comply with the land use laws. As far as the contradictions between the two applications and your question about the penalties for operating, I think you'd need to address those to the county. I can't answer on the part of the county what the consequences are for illegally operating a business without permits.
All right. And I think we have another call coming in. We're just getting it all set up here. But you mentioned that this happens at the county hearings officer then, coming up on June 24th, and then separate hearings then on two separate matters.
Exactly. Two hearings, one in the morning, one in the afternoon.
And from your perspective, how do you think it'll go?
Well, these are quasi-judicial hearings, which means they're basically legal hearings. And so no matter what you think about a case, whether you think your facts are 100% right or not, the legal interpretations can always surprise you. So it's really difficult to ever make a decision or prediction about how an outcome will be. I will add that citizen input is welcome at those hearings. There will be presentations by attorneys, et cetera, at the start of the hearing, but public comment is welcome and encouraged. And that's really the one of the main factors that Rogue Advocates, the reason that we exist is to encourage citizen involvement. And goal one of the state land use laws is citizen involvement. And so that's what we try to encourage.
All right, June 24th at the Jackson County Courthouse Auditorium?
Yes, Jackson County Auditorium. That's 10 South Oakdale.
Okay, and that's at 9 a.m. and 1:30 on the two different applications. I want to thank Steve Rouse, the board president, and Melissa Mathewson, the executive director at Rogue Advocates, for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange. Good to have you both.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Events Day is coming up. Here now is Garrison Keillor.
The Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 22nd of May, 2013. It's the birthday of Arthur Conan Doyle, born Edinburgh, 1859, studied medicine at the University of Edinburgh. His favorite professor was Joseph Bell, who taught his students how to make a successful diagnosis through observation and deduction. Doyle went into the practice of medicine after graduating, wrote fiction in his spare time, and in 1887, in the story A Study in Scarlet, he created a character based on his old professor, the detective Sherlock Holmes, who said, "Once you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. Nothing clears up a case so much as stating it to another person." And the person whom Sherlock Holmes stated his cases to, of course, was a doctor, Dr. Watson. Holmes said, "You have a grand gift for silence, Watson. It makes you quite invaluable as a companion." Conan Doyle ended up writing 56 short stories and 4 novels starring Sherlock Holmes, in each of which Holmes demonstrated the powers of deduction. "There is nothing more deceptive than an obvious fact," he said. "It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts." And it's the birthday of Peter Matheson, born in New York City, 1927, joined the Navy during World War II, went on to Yale. One of his professors at Yale asked if Matheson would like to work for the CIA, which was newly formed. Matheson asked if he could be sent to Paris, and the professor agreed. So, Matheson said, "out of sheer greed and opportunism, off I went." The CIA helped fund Matheson's founding of the Paris Review, and in Paris, Matheson infiltrated the circle of French communists to find out what they were up to. But as the McCarthy trials got attention in America, Matheson resigned from the CIA. spent 3 years working unsuccessfully as a commercial fisherman on Long Island, and in 1956, at the age of 29, took off across the country in a Ford with a sleeping bag, some books, a shotgun, and wrote a book about it called Wildlife in America, which caught the eye of the New Yorker magazine, where Matheson wrote about a trip to the Amazon, went on to write novels, including At Play in the Fields of the Lord and The Snow Leopard. Here's a poem for today by Hal Sirovitz, What Followed Your Birth. You might not like being reminded of your birthday, Father said, but your mother and I do. Your birth was a happy occasion. What followed was both good and bad. That was to be expected. But what we didn't expect was that you'd be the last of your friends to get a job, which you still haven't gotten yet. It just took you longer to get started. You had to go back to school. That wouldn't have been so bad if you were learning something. But after all these years, to still not know what you want for a present doesn't speak well for education. A poem by Hal Sirovitz, What Followed Your Birth, from his collection Father Said, published by Soft Skull Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering writing about finances, food, art, wine, and culture from around the world. More at wsj.com/celebrateweekend. Engineered by Noah Smith, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Garrison Keillor on the Jefferson Exchange with today's edition of the Writer's Almanac. Here with, as with every Wednesday, we open our Vents Day segment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Your chance to vent your spleen politely on a couple of topics in the news. And you can participate in Vents Day by calling us at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Today we'll be talking about election results and public university president pay. Yesterday was election day in Oregon, the kind of election that features mostly races for boards of school and fire districts and the like. There were some marquee issues out there, though, including public safety levies in Lane, Josephine, and Curry counties. In each case, voters were deciding whether to raise their property taxes to restore positions in sheriff's and district attorney's offices, positions lost when federal timber payments ground to a halt. Lane County voted yes. Curry County voted no, and it could be the first Oregon county to declare bankruptcy. We'll find out in the days ahead. Josephine County appears to have voted no. It was a 51-49 decision, and apparently no more votes still out there. Here's your chance to vent on the results or something else that concerned you in this election, or tell us if you had lived in one of the counties voting on a safety levy, how you would have voted. The numbers again on Vents Day, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Topic two on this Vents Day concerns paychecks, specifically those received by the presidents of public universities. A recently released annual survey of the salaries of the presidents of public four-year institutions showed some big numbers. The biggest number belonged to the fired president of Penn State University. Graham Spanier's compensation package totaled $2.9 million a year. The figures are a bit lower, closer to us. For example, no Oregon University president makes more than six figures, but is even six figures too much? How much is a state university president worth, especially in a time when program offerings are dropping and tuition continues to rise? Your thoughts on university president pay and the results of the levies and the other events in yesterday's election, welcome here on Vents Day on the Jefferson Exchange. 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, or jx@jeffnet.org. We'll take the calls in 1 minute. ¶¶ 836 on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. This is our Vents Day segment. You can vent your spleen politely on the topics in the news that we set before you. Today's topics are the results of yesterday's elections in various parts of Oregon, including the levies in Lane, Curry, and Josephine counties. Topic two is university presidents, public university presidents, and what they should be paid. We have results of that recent survey that indicates some of them are getting seven figures at public universities, although not in our neck of the woods. What do you think about these issues? Give us a call at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. The results again, Lane County 56 yes, 44% no. So the levy did pass to allow the jail to open up some more space in there. In Josephine County, it appears to be a narrow loss, 49% yes, 51% no on the public safety levy there. This is a sheriff's department that really only has 8 hours a day, sheriff's patrols on weekdays and not at any other regular time. And in Curry County, it was a much bigger levy because Curry County has a much lower property tax base. That one went down to defeat, pretty much the exact opposite of what happened in Lane County, 56% no to 44% yes. Your thoughts on what now happens if you live in one of those counties? In Lane County, you may be relieved. In Josephine County, quite the opposite. And if you don't live in one of those counties and had, how might you have voted or how did you perceive this from outside the zone? Give us a call at 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Wolfgang in Sunny Valley in Josephine County. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on Vents Day.
Good morning. I've never done the Vents Day.
Well,
and I'm
going to
be polite.
Oh, good.
And my call relates to, actually, in a way, to what Steve Rouse was talking about in the previous segment, that community involvement is what makes such a huge difference in what's necessary, because some of the election results, I'm in Josephine County, I'm affected by the 8-hour sheriff's patrols, which, of course, since I'm in Sunny Valley, don't get here.
Right.
And the other result is the opposite, that, for instance, a fire levy in Wolf Creek was passed in a place that does not provide services, right? Mm-hmm. And a board was re-elected, for the most part, that has been not quite prudently using all the money. I mean, they have a lot of money, and they want more, and they want more properties, and they want more of everything, and they haven't really put out a fire in a long, long time. And it's a, like, total vote count, I think, was 170.
Mm-hmm.
And that vote went for them because there was not enough community involvement. The people out here, like, they think, like, okay, this is my soup dish. I don't care what's beyond it. And I don't get involved. And that's how they end up with public monies being squandered and the money where it needs to go not being there. So that's basically the bottom line of what I'm talking about. People need to get involved.
Do you think if more people had gotten involved that the county public safety levy would have passed in Josephine County? It was very close. I mean, surprisingly close in a way.
I know, 51%. It's like very close. I think definitely yes. I also think that people don't believe that it makes any difference. And I also think that the whole ONC timber money is gone, and now we don't have any services thing is suspect to most people, and I think rightly so. That whole I wouldn't call it propaganda, but myth of here's ONC money gone, and suddenly we don't have a county anymore, is not quite transparent. It is not made transparent. People don't know how much of our county budget is really ONC, and therefore how many, let's say it's 5%, which I think what it is, and why do we need to cut 20% if we only lose 5%? It's not transparent, and that's in part why people don't trust this levy.
All right, so you have it sounds like you have two factions here, basically, people who would not raise taxes anyway, but also people who are concerned that the money is not being spent wisely, and those two factions together, certainly enough to defeat this levy.
You got that straight.
All right. Thanks for the call, Wolfgang. Always good to have you on the Jefferson Exchange. This is Vince Day on the Exchange. We're letting you vent your spleen politely on a couple of topics in the news. The broad topic, number one, is the results of yesterday's election, with the public safety levies passing in Lane County, failing in Curry and Josephine counties, and other topics as you choose to raise that you saw in yesterday's election. Topic two, pay for public university presidents, and should it be into seven figures as it is in some parts of the country, not generally in our part of the country. What's the appropriate figure? How, is anybody really worth seven figures, particularly working for a public institution like a university? 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Let me run through these quickly. I mentioned that Lane County did pass its levy 56-44. The general obligation bonds for the Eugene School District passed handily. The monthly fee for city, police, fire, homelessness, and other services in the city of Eugene went down in flames. Pretty much a 2-to-1 margin on that one. In Douglas County, let's see what we have here. Roseburg School District general obligation bonds, no, 58% to 42%. In Klamath County, making the commissioner positions nonpartisan beginning in the 2013, well, beginning this year. That was 2-to-1, yes, 67 to 33. In Klamath County for, let's see, this is the Klamath County School District, a school bond issue. I don't know final figures on this one. It was very close, 50.1% to 49.9%. That's really as close as a tie as you can get. We'll try to get final figures before the end of this hour. Measure 1749 in Josephine County was the criminal justice levy there. 51% no, 49% yes. City of Grants passed charter amendments, yes, 57% to 43% no. Grants Pass School District 7, capital improvement bond authorization, 51% no, 49% yes. Curry County, as we mentioned already, its five-year split rate operating levy to fund public safety services, a resounding no, 56% to 44%. What do you think about these results, and what do they say about the future of those counties? Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or jx@jeffnet.org. Topic two again, university president pay. Let's go to Tom in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on Vince Day.
Good morning.
Hi.
I live in the city of Grants Pass, so I still have police coverage. But I just went over the results that a 52% turnout, I guess that's not abnormal, but I guess what I'm stunned by is just the amount of misinformation and what people don't really know. People don't understand the definition of the word only, as in the funds were to be used only for criminal justice, and it's the feeling persists that, oh, no, they're going to do something different, so... I'm
right.
Really disappointed.
Yeah, I remember we heard that argument from the no on the measure people, and then it was pointed out to us by the yes on the measure people. If you look into the text of the thing itself, it does say only. It does specifically or did specifically restrict the use of the money that would have been raised by the levy had it passed for public safety. And in a close election, you're probably right. That was enough to make a difference.
I think it did, and I'm disappointed. I just wanted to add also that I moved here in the early 60s, and I just remember we went up to like the day before or the week before school was going to start before a levy would get passed. So that's we have a long history of not passing anything in this county.
Yes, that is unfortunately true. Thanks for the call, Tom. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Let's go on to Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. It's Vince Day.
Good morning. Did you know that I used to be the Oracle of the Caveman?
I did not.
I self-appointed. In any event, and I have comments on both subjects. First of all, in terms of the Josephine County levy, I can speak directly to that. I told the mayor, Darren, and I also told Pat Fahey repeatedly, show me deliverables, and I will vote for this. They never were able to do that. They never showed practical deliverables of how this money would be spent and how it would improve my safety and security. Now, my personal experience with the Sheriff's Department was back in the time when they really did have good money and the ONC money hadn't gone away yet or anything along those lines. I had a property crime, and the sheriff was a personal friend of mine at the time. I had a property crime, and it took 2 weeks to get a deputy to my property. I had fraud committed against me by an individual. Took the information. I'm a professional in investigations, and I took the information to the district attorney at the time, and they said, we don't know how to prosecute this. It was neatly wrapped up in a ball. We finally wound up taking it to the state level and getting some action on it. In a recent case with a heinous crime within a family, the owner of a business was specifically told that she would have input on what happened. Apparently a plea bargain was taken without her input, without her knowledge. As a result of that, she is now going to have to sell her business, relocate, and hide. And so, to me, I'm not seeing a criminal justice system or a criminal protection system that is delivering anything of any value to me whatsoever at the present time. And until I see those deliverables, they cannot expect me to support it.
Hmm.
Now, on the second issue, in terms
University president,
secondary education. I think that that's more a matter of all businesses and all operations. I think that the wages need to be flattened all the way around. I think that seven figures is probably not unreasonable in some situations in the current economy and in the current economic situation. However, when you have a CEO making 20 to 100 times the value of a primary worker, that's just inappropriate to begin with. They should, that whole wage scheme needs to be flattened, mm-hmm. so that people are working for the joy of work rather than for making vast sums of money. That's just my opinion.
All right. Lots to talk about there. Thanks for the call, Paul. Appreciate it. Let's move on to Jackie in Cave Junction. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on Vents Day. We're talking about the election results and about university president pay.
Jackie, hi, yes.
Go ahead.
You know, I want to actually comment more along the lines of the levy. I live in Cave Junction, Oregon, and I've lived for most of my life. When I was younger, we did have a full array of police officers that were able to obtain to our needs. Recently, my daughter, who's 12 years old, was attacked in Cave Junction. She was almost raped by a transient. It took us, I called 911 and they...
Jackie?
They said if he would have been raped, they could have done something about it, but because of where it was located and because of how bad it was, that it wasn't bad enough. I voted for the levy to go through. I understand that people are tired of paying money out. I get that. I am too. But in the same breath, when our children aren't safe and we can't get anyone to respond, that's a problem. And that's my comment. I feel like it's a problem when our babies aren't protected by our police force. That's a problem.
All right, Jackie, thanks so much for that call. Very much appreciated. Grumpy John in Grants Pass, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. It's Vents Day. We're talking about the results of the election, including the levy failures in Josephine and Curry County and the passing in Lane County.
Yes, Jeffrey, as you recall, before the election, you had a county commissioner on there, and I suggested that he was overpaid. And your personal response was, well, even if he reduced his salary or even if he didn't have a salary, that would barely touch the budget deficit. Jeffrey, I can do that math myself. The point which you ignored was the fact that his arrogant, entitled, I am not going to reduce my salary, I am entitled to it, is exactly the attitude we don't need. His attitude was, I got mine, and you guys are just going to have to deal with giving me more money. This attitude of it's all for me and I come first, I think, is exactly why people were smart enough to reject this levy. Nobody ever said, they claimed, this is just for the courts. That they didn't say, but by the way, that's going to enable us to slide some other funds to out of the courts and out of the justice system to pay for our exorbitant salaries and our vast and overpaid pensions.
All right, so let me follow down your trail a little bit here, because if, for example, the county commissioner said, you know what, we're going to take a $50,000 salary, no fringe benefits, starting today, if they put this levy back out there, would you have voted for it?
If they had also guaranteed that any increase in costs would not have allowed them to sleaze funds out of one account into the other, and if they had guaranteed that they were going to do something about these outrageous, my humble opinion, cushy retirement packages, perhaps. And if they'd, as the previous caller said, really showed where this money was going, how it was going to improve our lives. I too have had an incident with the police department. I was road raged by a guy. And the good old boy, the folks at down at City Hall said, "Oh, you don't have to come to the hearing." Well, as a result, the guy that permanently damaged my eye got off with a few hours of community service after having run me off the road, etc. So, yeah, I'm not really sure that even with the assurances, I would have voted for it. But if they had been more reasonable, and if they had really indicated a care for the county rather than a care for their pockets, maybe I would go along with it. But I don't see that happening.
Okay, got you loud and clear. Thanks for that, Grumpy John. Mark in Reading, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on Vince Day. We're talking about the results of yesterday's elections on the Oregon side and university president pay for public universities all around the country. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. Yes, I want to speak to the president, university president's salaries. Since most university presidents' real job is to get donations for their universities, I think they should be paid a percentage of what they get. Then, as long as it doesn't exceed that of the highest paid sports coach that's employed by the same university.
So how's that again? You'd have which one higher?
Well, neither. Uh-huh. You'd have the highest paid sports coach. The president never gets any more money than the highest paid sports coach.
All right. It seems like it often works the other way around, though. For example, the football coach at the University of Oregon tends to make a lot more money than the university president.
Oh, I'm aware of that.
Yeah.
But I think that they should get a percentage of what they take in, and that's how they should be paid. The more, because we're all very mercenary these days, the more money they're able to grab from whatever source for their university, the more they make an income.
All right. Thanks for that call, Mark. Appreciate it. We are talking on this Vince Day about university president pay and what is appropriate for the presidents of public institutions of higher education, four-year institutions of higher education. And we have some figures here on that. And also look at the results of yesterday's election and what you think about the levies in Lane County, which passed for public safety, in Josephine and Curry counties, which failed for public safety, and anything else you'd like to talk about involving yesterday's election. Phone numbers on the Exchange, 800-838-3760. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. An editorial in the Register Guard from May 17th points out about the Chronicle of Higher Education's report on the university president's salaries. It says the real shocker to people who don't follow college and university executives' pay was that U.S. public higher education now has a $1 million club. During the 2011-12 academic year, four presidents were found to have received more than $1 million in total compensation, up from three the previous school year. And they go on and list them. Nobody in our neck of the woods. It was from, let's see, Penn State University, Auburn University, Ohio State, and at George Mason University in Virginia. Two women at Ball State University and at Michigan ranked fifth and sixth, respectively, their packages exceeding $900,000. So the question again for all of us is, what's an appropriate level of pay for a public university, particularly at a time when public universities across the country, particularly in our two states, continue to lower program offerings and raise tuition? Your thoughts here on this Vince Day are welcome. Let's go to Vince in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. Yes, I was a college counselor for 29 years, and I saw the president's salary at my campus go higher and higher, and I thought it was outrageous that his salary would go higher and higher, as the gentleman before said, and he was hardly ever on campus. He was out in the community all over the state looking for grants and funds, even traveling internationally while the program that I worked for, disabled students, was cut every year. And he'd get to fly every month to the University of Copenhagen, the University of Bristol, come back for a few days. So the campus was really run by the vice presidents, and the president was hardly ever around, hardly ever participated. He showed up at graduation every June, and that was about it. And it was a disgrace, I thought. And after 29 years of trying to provide services to disabled students with smaller and smaller budgets and staff being cut, it just got ridiculous. And that's why I decided it was time to retire. They didn't think I would retire a year early, and I said, nope, I'm gone. I'm out of here. I'm not going to kill myself. And I thought it was really disgraceful. I think the president of a college should not be paid more than twice what any other faculty member or administrator is paid.
All right. That would certainly bring it way down into the lower six figures. Thanks for that, Vince. Good to talk to you. Let's move on to John and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange on Vince Day.
I was just going to comment on the Lane County levy. I appreciate the need for a jail that corrections facilities that work, but I have a couple of friends who retired at 56 from the county instead of 55, and their bonus for doing this was lifetime health care benefits for them and their spouse. And so I sometimes look at it and I go, are we really prioritizing properly here that we're giving lifetime health care benefits to people who retire at 56, but we don't have enough money for the jail and corrections facilities? So I'm glad it happened, but I wish we could get our priorities straighter.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. Let's go on to Dennis and Eugene. Final comment, it looks like, because we've got about a minute left here on Vince Day on the Jefferson Exchange.
Actually, I have a question.
Okay.
Maybe you can answer it. How do they decide how much a president gets paid? Isn't that the legislature or something?
Well, you know, it really depends on the institution of higher education you're talking about here. Because at Ohio State University, let's see, Gordon G. makes $2.5 million? No, $1.9 million, sorry. Interesting thing that you mentioned, though, because the former governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels, decided to tie his compensation package, where he is university president now, to the performance of the institution itself. And I'm looking for that. Is it right now? I lost it in my paperwork here. But here it is. Mitch Daniels is at Purdue University. $420,000 contract, slightly below median compensation for public colleges. And his bonuses are linked to student affordability, graduation, and student achievement. So, Dennis, does that sound like something you'd like to hear?
Yeah, well, I mean, that sounds reasonable. I just wondered, it seems like it's so arbitrary. That's all.
All right.
How do you decide? I don't know.
Okay, good question. Thanks for that. Dennis and Eugene on the Jefferson Exchange. This is Vince Day, has been Vince Day. Thanks for taking part. Thanks for listening. The Jefferson Exchange continues in a minute.